طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week, we continue our examination of the Israeli lobby, which, for decades, has distorted both the Israeli and Palestinian narrative to advance Israel's colonization of Palestine. Its enormous power was manifested this past week when it pressured Facebook, Zoom, and ultimately YouTube to deny their platforms to broadcast a pro-Palestinian forum at San Francisco University. Backed by millions of dollars of funding, the Israeli lobby has established a stranglehold on U.S. institutions of government, which historically have helped establish and continue to fund Israel's colonial project and their creation of a discriminatory apartheid society on Palestinian land. This morning on This Week in Palestine, we feature Akron University professor Walter Hickson, who has studied and written about the lobby over the past couple of decades, putting the issue in context at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. It begins with the introduction of Walter Hickson by the center's executive director, Mohammed Mohammed.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for joining us today. My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all here virtually. It's also a great pleasure to host Dr. Walter Hickson today, who will be giving a talk titled Appeasing Zion, the Israel Lobby and Injustice in Palestine. Since World War II, the Israel Lobby has exerted enormous influence over U.S. foreign policy. Yet with a few notable exceptions, scholars and journalists have done a poor job of researching and analyzing the lobby, in part because they are routinely smeared for doing so. Building on his previous study, Israel's Armor, the Israel Lobby and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict, Dr. Hickson explains how Israel and the U.S. lobby have collaborated for decades to distort history and fend off challenges to Israel's congenital aggression in Palestine. Dr. Hickson's talk will provide an overview of the history of the lobby, including its role in obscuring Israel's history of violent aggression, as well as the Zionist state's persistent opposition to pursuing a Middle East peace accord. The talk will conclude with discussion of the crucial role that the lobby and U.S. public opinion are playing in the present and future of the conflict. Today, the Israel lobby is mobilizing its considerable wealth and power to enhance and expand its propaganda mission. But at the same time, Zionist advocacy groups face unprecedented challenges that offer opportunities for the advocates of peace and justice in Palestine. A little bit about Dr. Hickson. He's the author of many books and articles, including most recently, Israel's Armor, the Israel Lobby, and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict. He also serves as contributing editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Dr. Hickson has been a history professor for 36 years, achieving the rank of distinguished professor at the University of Akron. His other books include American Settler Colonialism, A History, and The Myth of American Diplomacy, National Identity and U.S. Foreign Policy. So thank you, Dr. Hickson, for joining us today, and we look forward to this talk.
Well, thank you, Mohammed. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. Just thought I would give an overview of the lobby's history. Mohammed mentioned the book I did, Israel's Armor. It's on the first generation of the Palestinian conflict, culminating with the 1967 war and the beginning of the occupation. So I've continued to study the lobby and got another book that's under consideration now on the whole history of the lobby. As Mohammed mentioned, and I argue, the lobby is it's really understudied, and that is part of what underscores how powerful it is. Study of the lobby is deterred in part, as you mentioned, by smearing of critics. And this happened even with very prestigious scholars from the University of Chicago and Harvard, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, when they wrote the book, which is a solid book, The Israel Lobby, in 2006. So the book that I'm doing has additional chapters on the period since they left off, and some additional information on the period before that they didn't include. So I think it's the most comprehensive overall assessment of the history of the lobby, and be sure to let everybody know when that's done. So I'll talk about some of the findings and arguments that I make in that book, forthcoming book. First of all, we might as well briefly define what we mean by a lobby. I think it's best to use a small L and to understand that the lobby is not one organization, but many. Certainly AIPAC is the most well-known, even notorious, and the most significant. But there's a very important group called the Congress of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. And then there are just myriad other Jewish and Christian groups that form the small L lobby. So there's a whole wide range of groups that comprise the lobby and give it sort of sinews of power, make it very powerful because it is broadly based and extends into many groups. They're always creating new groups to lobby. Their business is Hasbara, is influencing foreign opinion, and it's especially important in the United States, which of course has been pivotal in funding Israel and making it the military powerhouse in the Middle East and enabling. So the title of the talk, Appeasing Zion, you could use appeasing as, of course, a pretty loaded term, but enabling, tilting, however you view it, there's no question that throughout the history of the Palestine issue, the United States has favored Israel and at the expense of justice and democracy in the region, really at the expense of a much more stable and effective Middle East diplomacy. It's helped keep the region unstable. It's contributed to a lot of violence, including major wars in the region. And so I think it's been just an absolutely disastrous policy and one that the lobby has kept afloat. So it does this by fundraising, by supporting candidates that support it, by smearing and punishing candidates that don't, really by working the Congress. So the Congress plays a really crucial role in the Israel lobby. The way this arose historically is that the State Department diplomats, back to the period around World War II when the lobby really took off, so a Zionist lobby preceded the Israel lobby, if you want to look at it that way. Before the creation of Israel, there had been the Zionist movement and influence in Congress and support for Zionism. But, I really view the modern lobby as beginning at 1942 with the Biltmore Conference in New York and taking off from there. In 1944, I was really struck as I did documentary research on this at the Center for Jewish History in New York, papers of Isaiah Kenen, who was really a founding figure in the lobby, K-E-N-E-N, a very unheralded person, but he was really the workhorse of the Israel lobby. And he realized in the elections of 1944 that the United States could have a critical influence on Congress. And ever since that time, really the Israel lobby has powerfully influenced, if not outright dominate, the U.S. Congress. And that's a tremendously important role. Well, the reason this arose is because the State Department was very critical of the early Israeli state. So Israel was an aggressive settler state from the outset. So this Mohammed quoted the term I use, congenital aggression. I think it's a very important term to understand Israel. It is a congenitally aggressive settler state. That doesn't make it particularly unique. The United States, in fact, is a congenitally aggressive settler state. And so is Australia, or was Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina, many others, Algeria, French Algeria. So the significant thing about Israel in this regard, and I'm going to talk more about this in a talk on October 21st through the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. We're doing a fall extra series. This is the groups that sponsor the annual Israel Lobby Conference, and we're doing an extra series this fall on the 21st. I'll talk about that. But briefly, to explain the importance of settler colonialism, settler states are in the business of driving people off their land and replacing them. That's what they do. They establish new facts on the ground. And Israel did this in Palestine with the Nakba, as we well know. So the importance of the lobby is, in a sense, to cover that up and to distort the Palestine issue ever since, to depict Israel as the sole democracy in the Middle East, as this being a deep-seated religious conflict that goes back to the Bible, et cetera, et cetera. It's really not. It's a pretty simple settler conflict of European settlers driving indigenous people off the land. But what's unique about Israel, as I said, there are many other settler states in history, including the United States, and it's one reason the U.S. supports Israel. But what's unique about Israel is that this happened in the latter part of the 20th century. And so it happened after the creation of the UN. It happened after a time when there's a lot of emphasis on the rights of indigenous people, on decolonization, on promoting democracy and not colonial oppression. So this is a problem for Israel that the lobby addresses with propaganda, with Hasbara. It distorts the conflict in order to obscure this basically unjust, aggressive, congenitally aggressive settler state that Israel formed. So that's one of the unique things about Israel, the timing of this, the late 20th century. The other unique aspect is, of course, is the Nazi genocide and the understandable desire of Jews for security and a great deal of global public sympathy for them. Understandably as well, that enabled a lot of this and played into it. So there are unique factors, and yet Israel parallels other settler states in history. So the lobby has been incredibly successful, very skillful. What is the lobby? Well, these are Americans. They're not Israelis. They're Americans, but they have always worked very closely with Israel. And you could even say in collusion with Israel. Sometimes the lines between them were very obscure. People had dual citizenship and so forth. So these are predominantly American Jews, but the lobby is not comprised today, certainly, only of Jews and never has been. Protestants and especially Protestant fundamentalists have always played a strong role in supporting Israel and in the Israel lobby. And today with CUFI, Citizens United for Israel, which APEC supports and funds, evangelical Protestants play a major role in the lobby. And of course, not all Jews are supportive of Israel or the lobby, and that's becoming more and more of a problem. In fact, the Israel Lobby Extra Conference next Thursday will focus on scholars who point out, and activists that the Jewish community is divided today and becoming increasingly divided over support for Israel. And that's a very promising thing for those of us who want to pursue peace and justice in Palestine. So it's made comprised of Jews as well as Christians, but obviously not all Jews and Christians support the lobby. Very successful. Israel is a country, a small country of 9 million people, and yet it's the most heavily funded country in the history of U.S. foreign policy in terms of U.S. assistance, predominantly military. It doesn't matter who's in the presidency, Republican, Democrat. Israel has been tremendously well-funded. $38 billion 10-year agreement is in flow right now. This has enabled Israel to be the predominant military power in the region and to act to pursue its congenital aggression with great power behind it. So despite its being a small country, heavily funded, heavily militarized with the assistance of the United States. So I argue that unquestionably, I don't think there's any doubt about this, the Israel lobby is the most powerful lobby representing the interests of a foreign country in all of American history. There's no other country, China, the Republic of China before communism, or Miami Cubans, whatever you want to point to, Ireland, none of them match the Israel lobby in its influence on American culture and politics. It's not all created by the lobby. There are a lot of fundamental cultural identifications between Israel and the United States, including the background of both as settler colonies. But overall, the lobby's been tremendously effective. That being said, I think it has real challenges currently, and we'll get to that in the end and with some questions and answers. So how does the lobby work? It lobbies the Congress. It raises money. When issues come up, it launches, used to be telephone campaigns and telegram campaigns, and now obviously it's email campaigns. Public demonstrations, major demonstrations have occurred periodically in Washington and around the country throughout the history. When something comes up that the lobby doesn't, that Israel and the lobby oppose, they'll launch a major Hasbara campaign and try to fend it off. Usually they are successful in this historically. Some people who underestimate the lobby, and this is a phenomenon that's kind of really hard to get a handle on, even some people who are otherwise very critical of Israeli policy, often for whatever reason, downplay the lobby, which makes no sense. The lobby is very powerful and very influential. There's a reason they're growing like mad right now and more than doubling their personnel up to about 300 people, building a new building for the second time in the last 12 years in Washington. I mean, they're smart and they're not expanding for no reason at all. They're expanding because they are effective and powerful. And people in Washington know that the Israel lobby is powerful, like the gun lobby is powerful, like Big Pharma is powerful, like the elderly person's lobby is powerful. It's a powerful lobby. And rare defeats, for example, 1981, when the Saudis purchased AWACS planes, or the Iran treaty was also cited. See, the lobby's not that powerful. Obama got the Iran treaty. Well, look what happened to the Iran treaty. And, the Saudis were rejected for a bid for weapons several years after that 1981 purchase. Moreover, whenever, and this will happen with the recent deal with the UAE as well, whenever an Arab country signs an arms agreement with the United States, the Israelis oppose it, but they use that, Israel and the lobby uses that, to get more weapons of their own. So the lobby's been extremely successful. It's extremely powerful, and it is wrong and a mistake for especially progressive people to downplay the influence of the lobby. There's not some grand conspiracy here. It's all out in the open. They do their thing, but they do it, and they do it well, and they've been very influential. Now, as I mentioned, there are issues that they face and challenges that they face. So what has the lobby gotten out of this historically? What has Israel and the lobby succeeded in getting out of the United States? Well, all the money, I mentioned that, the Israeli military power, borderland aggression. So beginning in 1948, Israel expanded its borders. Defiance, absolute nose-thumbing defiance of the UN. I think this has not been well appreciated. The UN was a really great hope for the world at the end of World War II. This international organization built in New York, spearheaded by the United States, largely funded by the United States, and Israel has helped undermine the UN. And the U.S. enabling appeasing of Israel has helped undermine the UN rather than support the UN as an anchor for peace and justice in the world. So I don't think this has been well appreciated, beginning with the assassination of the UN envoy in 1948 by Israeli terrorists. Israel and the lobby have defied the UN and showed utter contempt for the UN, which of course has tried to call Israel to account for its just regular campaign of violations of international law. So borderland aggression is another aspect, defiance of the UN. Jerusalem, moving in on Jerusalem, which is a source of tremendous instability. In promoting tremendous instability, Jerusalem is a sacred place for three religious traditions, not one. And so the effort to dominate Israel and the cleansing that's going on in East Jerusalem today have been tremendously destabilizing, and something else that has been steady progress that Israel and the lobby have supported. What else? Continuing disdain for Palestinian refugees. You can see this throughout the history of Israel. From the get-go, from the Nakba to today, utter disdain for the issue of these Palestinian refugees, originally 750,000 and millions today. Another aspect of this that is little appreciated and ironic even is the U.S., and this is outright appeasement of the Israeli nuclear program. So if you look at the history of this, it's all available in the foreign relations documents, and National Security Archive in Washington has excellent stuff on this online. Israel pursued a nuclear weapons program in defiance of U.S.-led efforts to contain the proliferation of nuclear weapons, or at least what purported to be U.S. efforts to contain them, such as the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel blatantly lied to the United States again and again about its nuclear program until it could present to the U.S. and the world a fait accompli. So again, this is another aspect wherein Israel and the lobby have been appeased. And so I say ironic because of course, the intense and vitriolic demonization of Iran and the effort to contain Iran, which even after it's contained with the Obama Treaty, that's not good enough for Israel and the lobby, and they want essentially have been calling for war with Iran for the most part as a preferred option. So another aspect of this long history of U.S. appeasement of Israel and the lobby is the Israeli nuclear program doing precisely what it promised not to do, introducing nuclear weapons into the Middle East and then the threatening war with Iran. Of course, there was a bombing of the Iraqi reactor in 1981. So violent efforts to contain any other nuclear power. Could have kept nuclear weapons completely out of the Middle East, but Israel didn't do that. And the United States allowed it, enabled it. Obviously, settlements. The lobby's justification for settlements or Hezbollah on settlements. Hezbollah is the Hebrew word for foreign propaganda, is almost laughable. The position of the lobby has been that settlements are no big deal. They've been going on ever since Israel began, so what's the big deal? It's just, they elide this kind of highly destabilizing illegal occupation, acts of war in the West Bank, Golan Heights, of course, the nightmare of Gaza, and have depicted settlements as just nothing but Arab propaganda to make a big deal about it. So those are the consequences of the power of the lobby. Israel's aggression, its extreme violence that has been displayed in Lebanon, in Gaza, and elsewhere. And these have all been enabled by the United States. So where are we now? I think we're at a really interesting time today. I'll talk about that for a few more minutes, and then we can stop and open up to any questions or see what's coming in from the viewers. But it's been a very slow process, but there is materializing significant opposition and more and more meaningful publicity of Israel in the lobby, which is why I get so irritated by progressives who don't understand, apparently, or are willing to accept that the lobby is powerful and important and must be, you know, attacked head on. But the progressives in Congress, Bernie Sanders' campaign was really important. The fact that this progressive American, a Jew, came out and said that Israel, that Netanyahu was racist and Israel should not be funded, or its funding should be linked to its compliance with international law and justice and democracy. That was very important. Obviously, he didn't get the nomination, and a Biden campaign offers, you know, very little progressive hope. Nonetheless, Ocasio-Cortez is having some influence on the Democratic Party. Ilhan Omar is having influence. Rashida Tlaib is having influence. Betty McCollum is having influence. The Israel lobby went all out for candidates like Elliot Engel in New York in the recent primaries, and he was totally defeated by soon-to-be Representative Bowman. They went after Ilhan Omar, and she won in a landslide. The lobby got its fierce reputation by targeting candidates, even powerful members of Congress like J. William Fulbright, who was a prominent early critic of the Israel lobby, and he understood very well what the lobby did and the power that it exercised. They targeted Charles Piercy, head of the Foreign Relations Committee. This is when the lobby really became powerful in the 70s and 80s, but today it's losing a lot of congressional campaigns. And the progressives are there in Congress, and they're not backing down. Betty McCollum has introduced powerful legislation to protect incarcerated Palestinian children. So there's real promise there. There's promise in the Jewish community. Jewish Voice for Peace has been, has embraced BDS, has championed Omar and other progressive candidates. JVP Action has been very active in fundraising and supporting these candidates who are critical of Israel and the lobby and want peace and justice in Palestine and the Middle East. Much more mainstream and in line with the traditional Democratic Party is the other Jewish group, whose name is escaping me right now. I'll think of it in a second, but not JVP, but J Street. So J Street, Peter Beinart has famously talked about the crisis of Zionism, and now he has said that the two-state solution just is not going to happen and is not practicable. And because of the occupation, because of all the settlement, it's what we need now is a peaceful and democratic single-state solution in Palestine. That's a historic move for him to make that has really frightened the lobby and traditional advocates of ongoing repression and injustice. So more and more, this idea that Israel is the sole democracy in the Middle East is coming unglued because it's a false narrative. Israel is an apartheid state. It marginalizes the Palestinians in its midst. They are not equal citizens. But moreover, it is a colonial occupier of territory that it is threatening to annex and has already annexed other territory. So you cannot square this with sole democracy. Israel's a settler colonial state. It's a colonizing state. It's a de facto apartheid state. And people like Beinart have acknowledged this fact. So the BLM movement, Black Lives Matter movement, right now, unfortunately, I don't see a lot of convergence between BLM and race-based oppression in Palestine. There needs to be a convergence. And so I hope that things will move in that direction. But there are a lot of forces, if you're sitting in these major well-funded posh lobby offices in Washington, they're fully aware of these. And that's why the lobby is important and people need to understand it's important. It continues to raise millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. It continues to build strength. It continues to engage in Hezbollah. And it's not going away. And it'll fight this. It'll use every tactic. Smear tactics are common with the lobby. They have no shame about this. And so they'll fight hard and fight to the end and should not be underestimated. But that said, there are these forces rising against the lobby, and we'll see if they can't have some impact in the future. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we are moving, albeit obviously at a glacial pace, toward meaningful peace and justice in Palestine. I think, Mohammed, I'll leave it at there. I've said a lot, I'm sure I can go back and fill in some gaps if people have questions about them.
Thank you, Dr. Hickson. Thanks for the great summary of the Israel lobby. We have a question from Saeed Arakat, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Al-Quds Daily here in Al-Quds Daily newspaper. And he asks, how can Americans fight or expose the lobby without being accused of anti-Semitism, as we saw with Ilhan Omar, for example?
Well, again, they will certainly do that. They'll use smear tactics, and as we've seen in the campaign against BDS, they've enjoyed a lot of success with this, frankly, with linking BDS. You know, a lot of people routinely, you know, view BDS as anti-Semitic. There's nothing anti-Semitic about it at all. It's a justice and democracy movement for equal rights and to bring pressure on Israel to supply that. But yes, they'll play that card and use that canard. It just has to be exposed for what it is. Betty McCollum did a great job with this. So she's the representative from Minnesota who proposed legislation to ensure that no U.S. funding would support the incarceration and torture and beating of children in Palestine. Of course, AIPAC opposes this, and the Congress opposes even defense of children in prisons in Israel. But they, the lobby attacked her over this and called her an anti-Semitic. And she fired back and said, AIPAC is behaving like a hate group, not like a lobby, like a hate group. So, you know, to some extent, Betty McCollum very effectively fought fire with fire, except she didn't smear. She told the truth that they're using hate tactics. So this has to be exposed. And you have to obviously support candidates who are, there aren't still a majority by any stretch, but who are willing to do this. So you have to stand up to the lobby and support candidates who'll do it. You have to out the lobby for what they are and for the tactics they use and refuse to be intimidated by this.
Well, in the case of that bill, it's actually it's kind of ridiculous that anybody would be even opposed to such a bill. It only touches on the issue of children being affected by, by Israel's military or forces. So it's amazing that people can actually oppose such a bill and with a straight face, basically.
It is amazing. And I think part of what's at stake for AIPAC speaks to this. It is accustomed to utterly dominating the Congress. And when there's any chance that it is losing ground with the Congress, they get very nervous. We've seen this recently also. It was very interesting that AIPAC did say that it would not target and punish candidates who tried to draw the line at the proposed or impending annexation of the Jordan Valley and areas of the West Bank. The lobby did say, AIPAC did say, you can criticize that and we won't target you. So that's pretty significant too. And it I think shows that the lobby doesn't want to push its luck too much, but they're used to absolute flat out controlling the Congress, and they get real nervous when they are unable to do that, even with a bill, as you say, which is just, you know, you would think everybody would be in favor of protecting the lives of children. That would be nice if you could think that.
So we also, everyone also knows by now about the deal between the UAE and Israel. Obviously, the administration probably has an interest in making that happen. But to what extent, if any, do you think the lobby was involved with that? And then actually today, I think also there's news that Kosovo and Serbia have reached an agreement, which also includes Kosovo recognizing Israel. So to what extent is the lobby involved in these types of deals?
Well, essentially, these deals are a Trump effort to obviously promote his reelection campaign to try to overcome all the obvious truths of his behavior and depict himself as a statesman. But, you know, they're to act presidential and to get these make maximum fanfare behind these agreements, which are really not all that significant. On the other hand, Jared Kushner is pretty shrewd, and he's behind these, the president's son-in-law, and of course was behind the so-called deal of the century as well. And he's trying to line up things to isolate and undermine Palestinian rights. And these are steps in that direction. So partly these are Trump campaign initiatives. The lobby is all in, obviously, on getting recognition of Israel by Kosovo, or especially the UAE, which is obviously more significant than Kosovo, a tiny little principality nonetheless, you know, was something that they got. But on the other hand, the UAE wants U.S. strategic aircraft, and Israel's not thrilled about that. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, Israel simply uses arms deals the United States makes with Arab countries to get more weapons of its own. They literally have done this for decades. They go in and say, look, you gave the Arabs this, now you got to give us more. And there's, of course, an agreement that Israel will always have qualitative military superiority in the region. And so they're not that alarmed about these arms deals with Arab countries because they just use them to get more weapons of their own. So the lobbies, you know, Trump's been a godsend for the Israel lobby. Not that the Democrats were, I mean, you know, Obama, despite the unbelievably contemptuous treatment of him by Israel and the lobby. Obviously, you recall bringing in Netanyahu for that congressional humiliating effort to humiliate the American president. Despite their contemptuous treatment of him, Obama signed the 10-year, $38 billion agreement and hardly tried to rein in Israel and maintain the special relationship. But Trump, of course, they've gotten anything and everything they've wanted. So it's been a mutually beneficial relationship. So I don't think the lobby was behind the UAE deal or this Kosovo thing precisely, but I don't think it was happy about it and not terribly alarmed about the arms sales.
Now, I think, you know, whether it's Israel, but any other country, you could say that it's pretty unethical to have a foreign power being so deeply entrenched into the American government. And how do you see this in the future? I mean, do you think there'll be more strict controls over lobbies like this, or what do you think about that?
Well, I'm not an expert on the law, but there are laws about that the lobby's always skirted along the edge about what's proper. And this is another way that that Trump's been a godsend because he would never call them on any of this, and they could step over any bounds. But there are legal bounds in 1939 law about what foreign lobbies can do. And this has sometimes led to So one of the reasons they targeted Fulbright, who I mentioned earlier back in the 70s, is because he did launch a congressional investigation of this. But this was way back in 1961, 62. And ever since then, and partly because Fulbright was ousted, targeted and ousted as a result, Congress hasn't had the nerve. So they make the laws. And I think we're a long way from Congress reining in the Israel lobby through law. But I think it has to come through public pressure. You know, the same way that the BLM is making progress, the same way gay, lesbian, and transgendered people made progress. You advocate for these rights and justice, and you advocate and you advocate. And one day you get breakthroughs. And so I'm hoping that there's going to be a Palestinian moment coming soon. So I think we're more likely to make progress that way than by reining in this lobby legally.
And to your knowledge, just out of curiosity, has anybody ever been in trouble for associated with the lobby, have been in trouble for any of their actions by violating the law?
A couple of occasions, but nothing very significant. There was a very interesting lobbyist named Abraham Feinberg back to the 40s and the 50s, who really is a New York financier for the Democratic Party and for the lobby, really played an instrumental role in getting the Israel lobby lined up with the Democratic Party. He was indicted, but never really suffered consequences. There have even been some in the Institute of Research Middle East Policy has interesting documents that's unearthed on all this. There have even been some organized crime elements going back in American history that were connected with the Zionist lobby. But in answer to your question, not really. There hasn't been a calling to account. Even by contrast, if you think about, for example, the spy Jonathan Pollard, who's now been let out of prison. He spied for Israel. You know, you're going to never see people who spy for Russia or China or some other country let out of prison, but Pollard got out of prison. So there's never been equal justice for Israelis in this regard. There's always been a kind of privileged position.
And actually, funny that you mentioned, there's Grant Smith, of course, at IRMEP, who did a great book on the lobby and how they basically got into state government as well and pushed many deals with between Israeli companies and local local cities and towns.
Yes, and Grant's unearthed all these documents that are pertaining to the aspects that I just mentioned. But again, you know, you raise a very good point based on Grant Smith's most recent book, and that is that the lobby's not going away. The lobby remains influential, and it is indeed expanding into state government. He does a really nice job of showing its influence in both commerce and politics, and getting, as usual, money for these activities in the state of Virginia. So, yes, the lobby's expanded into state politics as well.
And I guess a final question. So, obviously, you know, things are changing in the Democratic Party. But, of course, we know that historically Israel has been a bipartisan issue. So do you think things are moving away from that, or do you think it will still have a hold on the Democratic Party as well?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the bipartisan issue, because this has been an absolute staple of AIPAC philosophy from the very beginning, never to be purely identified with one party. They've been very shrewd in that way and always worked both political parties and done so very effectively. On the other hand, one of the dangers in lining yourself up with an extremist like Trump is that, you know, if he loses and is out of the way, then and of course the whole Republican Party faces this dilemma now, because they've appeased Trump so much that they're, you know, aligned with him. But I think that's one reason why the lobby at the AIPAC said, look, if you want to criticize the impending annexation, we won't target you, because they're afraid of completely alienating Democrats. So I think you need what's most significant in the future is that the progressives really need to they kind of didn't get very far in the recent platform And that's another thing the lobby's always been brilliant at. For, throughout its history, it has made it an effort, and a very successful effort, to get involved in the drafting of the party planks during every presidential election. So they're deeply ensconced in both political parties, and it's going to take not only these progressive members that we've talked about, whose names we've mentioned and you all know, but it's going to take more members, but it's going to take BLM-style grassroots efforts to put pressure. And then the Democratic Party, if it has to respond to that pressure. Joe Biden's not going to do it, and neither is Kamala Harris, unless they're pressured. And so it has to come from the bottom up, from the grassroots. But that Palestinian moment could happen. The BLM moment sort of is happening. And, you know, I hold out hope that it can happen.
Great. Thank you. And just about Israel's Armor is already out. That's correct, right?
Yeah. Israel's Armor was published in 2019 and takes it through the first generation of the Palestine conflict. And maybe you can have me back when I get the other one out and we'll revisit it.
Of course. Yeah, you're always welcome here. And for everybody watching, please check out his book. I'm guessing you could find it on Amazon.
Yeah, or at Middle East Books and More in Washington, you can get probably discounted copies there. Excellent bookstore in Washington. You can order online and get it from Middle East Books and More.
Yeah, so let's go to Middle East Books and More instead of Amazon.
Good idea.
All right, well, thank you so much, Dr. Walter, for such a great great presentation.
And well, thank you, Muhammad. For everybody, it's an honor to be with you.
For everybody watching, please, you will find this video on our YouTube channel later if you want to pass it along to your friends and family. And thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Dr. Walter.
You have been listening to Akron University Professor Walter Hickson speaking in August of 2020 at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on our computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. خيام إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم من